Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On Thursday, the Supreme Court blocked the Trump administration's attempt to end the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, also known as DACA. The 2012 Obama-era program protects around 800,000 young adults and teens, also known as Dreamers. They were brought to the United States as children. DACA protects them from deportation and allows them to work and go to school in the U.S. According to a study by the Center for American Progress, 1.5 million people across the country live in a household with a DACA recipient, and nearly 184,000 DACA recipients live in California, more than any other state. In a 5-4 decision, Chief Justice John Roberts, writing with the liberals, found that the Trump administration acted unlawfully when they ended the program. Trump can still try to end DACA despite the court's ruling, but immigration experts say a clear path to citizenship is the only way to guarantee protection. Joining us to talk about this major ruling are three guests. Adrian Escarte was born in Santiago, Chile. He came to the United States when he was just 3 years old. He found out about his undocumented status when he was 12. Despite major challenges, he put himself through college and is now a professional tennis coach in Miami, Florida, and communications director of Define America, a media advocacy organization that fights injustice and anti-immigrant hate through the power of storytelling. Hi, Adrian. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by Roberto Gonzalez, professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education and director of the school's immigration initiative. Professor Gonzalez has been working with and researching undocumented youth for 28 years. He is the author of the award-winning book, Lives in Limbo, Undocumented and Coming of Age in America. It is based on a study that followed 150 undocumented young adults in LA for 12 years. Hi, Professor Gonzalez. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Luis Cortez Romero came to California as a toddler from Mexico and is a DACA recipient. In a tweet, he writes that receiving DACA in 2013 changed his life. 6 years later, he was one of the lawyers defending the program at the Supreme Court. Luis Cortez Romero is an immigration attorney and partner with the Immigrant Advocacy and Litigation Center in Washington State. Hi, Luis. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have all of you. I'd love to just hear your response to the ruling. Adrian, let's start with you. What was your response when you heard the ruling?
It's still kind of hard to believe. I was bracing for the worst. And I think, like many other dreamers, many other DACA recipients across the country, we were not certain that they were going to rule in our favor. There had been other litigation that hadn't necessarily gone pro-immigration, like the public charge rule. So honestly, I myself wasn't keeping my hopes up. So when the decision came down on Thursday morning and in favor for the DACA plaintiffs, I couldn't believe it. I was very relieved. It was a huge sigh of relief. But we also can't forget that the fight continues, and that permanent legislation must be passed in Congress to finally be put at ease and have that protection that we all want to have.
Right. And we will talk about what it will take to see a path to citizenship. What about you, Professor Gonzalez? What was your response?
Yeah, I think very similarly. I've been talking to a lot of folks, and there wasn't a lot of optimism for a positive ruling for DACA. And so when the decision came down, I was elated. I think that this represents a major victory. I spent a long time thinking about this issue and talking to young people. And so, you know, I think, well, I think that this by no means at all solves this issue. You know, I think that it allows people to breathe easier, at least momentarily, to kind of gather up the forces and mobilize to kind of push for something more broadly.
Luis, you are one of the lawyers who defended the program at the Supreme Court. Before you give us your reaction, can you just talk about the language? Chief Justice John Roberts, writing with the liberals, found that the administration acted unlawfully when they ended the program. He also wrote that they reject Trump's rationale for canceling the program as arbitrary and capricious. What can you tell us about the significance of that language and the ruling overall?
Yeah, so, you know, one of our biggest arguments was that the way in which President Trump terminated the program violated the Administrative and Procedures Act, or the APA. And one way we show that an administrative agency violated the APA is if we can show they acted arbitrarily and capriciously. So we have to provide examples of how they did that in terminating the program. And here, it was pretty clear that they seemed to act first without any real regard to any of the consequences and the potential outcomes of ending the program so abruptly, particularly how much all of our communities relied on DACA, not just the DACA recipients, but the communities that rely on DACA recipients, from healthcare workers to the agricultural workers to the teachers to the doctors and lawyers to the janitorial staff. And so, you know, it was the lack of those considerations that made the administrative act arbitrary and capricious. And we're very glad that Chief Justice Roberts saw that.
What was your response, given that you are a dreamer yourself and one of the lawyers defending the program?
Yeah, you know, I do echo a lot of the responses that we were feeling a bit pessimistic. It was hard to, you know, leaving the courtroom in November after the oral arguments, it was kind of hard to figure out where the justices were leaning, but it was hard to feel optimistic given the tenor of the questions. The Monday before the DACA decision came out, there was a LGBT case that came out that provided protections for the LGBT community in the workplace setting, and that makeup of that decision was surprising. Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Gorsuch sided with the more liberal side of the court, and so that to me signaled that maybe we can't always guess how the court's going to rule. So I was, you know, that made me feel a bit more optimistic about the decision. Yet, you know, I was a bit cautious. And so when the decision came out, we saw that Chief Justice Roberts wrote the opinion and that he sided with the four other justices. It was surprising because I think I was almost bracing for impact.
Adrian, you were born in Santiago, Chile. You came to the United States when you were just 3. And you found out about your undocumented status when you were 12. I was just watching a video of young people talking about the stress of being undocumented. I mean, in these days, it's stressful enough to try to apply to college, to pay for college, to find a place to live, just do basic things. It's very, very difficult. Can you just talk about the challenges that you and so many other undocumented young people face just trying to live your lives?
I completely echo that sentiment. It's just a like a whirlwind, a roller coaster of hurdles that you have to go through when you're undocumented. I found out that I was undocumented, like you said, at 12 years old. My grandfather was very sick and ill in Chile, and my father wasn't able to go see his own dying father in his last few minutes of life because he risked going back to Chile and then not being able to come back to the country that we were living in here. So that's when I found out, but it didn't start really impacting me until, like most undocumented kids find out when they're applying to colleges and they don't have a social security number, or you go and try to get a driver's license and you can't fill out the paperwork. So I just knew from the moment that my parents told us that we are quote unquote different from everybody else, that it was going to be more difficult. But that motivated me more to achieve the things that I've been able to achieve. I dreamed of being a professional tennis player, but I wasn't able to because of my status. I wasn't able to travel to different tennis tournaments around the country and around the world. And I was still able to go to college, and I was able to get private scholarships academically and from tennis. So I was able to go and play 4 years of college tennis. I was working as a professional tennis coach for almost the last 10 years. And after DACA, I felt like finally I was able to have some freedom, because I was able to be hired by a really prestigious tennis club in Miami when I was living there at the time. And I was even able to try out and be a practice partner for the professionals, for the tennis professionals. And I was able to achieve my dream to actually practice and warm up Roger Federer before his final against Rafael Nadal at the Miami Open in 2017. So I just think it's a testament to most of just us, like the dreamers, undocumented folks across the country, that whatever obstacle comes our way, we strive to get through it. But also knowing that, like you said, it's a really big toll on the mental health of folks. And many times you struggle with knowing that you might be able, I mean, you might get picked up by ICE, or you might run a red light and get detained, and there's a lot of these scenarios that cross your mind when you live in this country without papers. And it's super unfortunate, because like all undocumented folks, all 11 million of us, just want to contribute and be a part of this country in every way we can.
Luis, can you also talk about the challenges and just how difficult this all is? You came to the U.S. in 1989 as a toddler from Mexico, and you and your family, based on what I've read, I've seen some videos of you, you've all endured a lot. Your father was actually deported back in 2004.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I realized is I knew that I wasn't born here and that I was undocumented from a really early age. But my life has really just been a series of events of figuring out what that really means and what that really looks like. And very similar to the experiences that were just explained, you know, one of my first experiences of feeling different and knowing what that meant was in eighth grade, when my class was taking a trip to Europe and we had fundraised to try to get it, to go to this trip in Europe. And you know, at the end of the day, I wasn't allowed to go because I wasn't born here. And then in high school, I was, you know, very excited to get my driver's license. I passed driver's ed. And at the time, you know, there was then Governor Schwarzenegger who did not allow driver's licenses for people without lawful status. And so I, again, was limited to my peers because I wasn't born here. My father was deported, and I, you know, that to me was one of the most mind-boggling components of it, because I had, you know, someone who had no criminal history, was paying their taxes, was a contributing member to society, tried to get their lawful status, and it didn't work. It backfired completely, and he was told to leave. And I just didn't know why we weren't able to fully participate in our community. Again, it happened again when I went to college. I went to San Jose State in San Jose, and again, I ran into challenges regarding tuition because we aren't able to get financial aid. And really, it went all the way up to law school. When I was in law school, I realized that once I was there, that I probably would not be able to practice law, again, because I wasn't born here. And so these are the series of events of just, you know, realizing that you're limited because of where you were born. And it wasn't until my last year in law school that DACA was announced. And, you know, the timing of it couldn't have been better, because I was about to graduate law school and DACA provided me with some of the basic building blocks that allows me to participate fully in my community, from a social security to work authorization, and allowed me to take the bar and, you know, and sit for the bar. And then, you know, from there, I felt so privileged that now I'm able to protect the program that really, you know, provided me so much. And one other thing I will say about the program that I think people miss out on a lot is, yes, it's a temporary program, and yes, it only goes in 2-year increments where you have to renew. But at least for me, one of the things that it did is that it created a permanent shift in my soul, really. Mm-hmm. You know, we had this sort of Damocles hanging over us of deportation, and once that's gone, even for a little bit, once you don't have to worry about being deported for those 2-year increments that you're renewing your DACA, I didn't realize how heavy that was until that weight was off of me. And that's a genie you can't put back in the bottle. You know, once you feel that sense of liberation, at least for me, I felt so empowered. And so I knew that going into this litigation, that even if DACA were to end, one of the things that they couldn't take away from DACA recipients and really the activist movement that got us DACA to begin with was the empowerment that we felt of being unafraid. And so, you know, there was a series of challenges, and I think that's really what it means to be undocumented in America, is living your life with a series of challenges, figuring out that this is what it means to be undocumented.
Was your father ever able to come back to reunite with you all?
You know, one of the things that I realized when my dad was deported, and what I really set out to do in law school, was try to figure out why the immigration system was broken and why it would lead to this permanent separation of families, right? I have U.S. citizen siblings and, you know, wonder why they wouldn't be able to do anything. And so I wanted to figure out why the immigration system was broken and why it would lead to this permanent, you know, separation. And once I got to law school, I realized that it's not that the immigration system is broken. It's actually functioning as intended, mm-hmm. to try to provide as little resources as possible for someone like my dad to not have the legal capacity to, you know, be reunited with his family once he takes that plunge to do that. So, you know, I think it really underscores the fact that we need broader immigration reform to not just have a pathway for dreamers and for the DACA recipients, but for the original dreamers, which is our parents who dreamt about our future and risked everything for it.
Well, and speaking of your parents, Luis, I watched the video this morning of your mom reuniting with her parents after 3 decades of not seeing each other. In the tweet, you said, when I went to law school, I vowed to figure out a way to reunite them and was able to help them get visas. And it just, it was amazing to watch this and to think that your mom has not seen her parents in 3 decades and they're only in Mexico, not that far away.
Right. I mean, I think that this really underscores like how the immigration laws really strip immigrants from dignity a lot of the time, you know? And so my mom was not able to visit her, has not been able to see her parents in 3 decades. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, particularly for a country like Mexico, it's very difficult to get visitors visas. And just to compare and contrast for people who may not know, there are some countries that don't even need a visa to enter the United States. So we definitely are living in a situation where not all immigrants are created equal. And we're talking about, you know, some of the laws are more flexible for some of the individuals in Europe, who are born in Europe and other parts of that country or that area. But someone like Mexico, you need to get a visa, and it's exceptionally difficult. We tried multiple times for my grandparents. It took almost 2 years before we were able to actually secure a visa for my grandparents, for them to come visit temporarily. And so I was able to get my parents, my mom and her parents, to see each other for the first time in 3 decades. And so, you know, it's this type of family reunification that are really at core of American values. And, you know, and I think that the Senate majority, the Republican Party, should really acknowledge that, you know, immigrant values are very much American values, family values that the Republican Party aligns itself with. And so I think, you know, it's time for them to catch up and see that, you know, we have a lot more in common than we think. And so, you know, getting them to be reunited after 3 decades was a very magical moment. But it also reminded me that there's so many people out there who are also going through this. I was sent hundreds of messages after I posted the video of people in the exact same boat who are not able to see their loved ones, who are just across the border, some of them in San Diego. who are, you know, who are family members are in Tijuana and they're not able to see each other. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, again, we have very outdated immigration laws that need to be, you know, restructured to provide some basic dignity to immigrants.
Well, it was incredible to watch that video. Professor Gonzalez, you have studied the outcomes of undocumented youth for 28 years, and you have called DACA one of the most successful policies of immigrant integration of the last three decades. Can you talk about the significance of DACA?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for that question. So, you know, I think that to provide some context to the really powerful narratives of both Adrian and Luis, you know, I'd spent two decades before DACA really trying to understand what happens to undocumented children as they make these critical transitions from adolescence to young adulthood. And, you know, in talking to, you know, at this point, by the time DACA was initiated, hundreds of young people, and they shared a really common story. These are young people that, you know, come to the U.S. as children and are integrated from day one into the public school system. And as such, they have the opportunities to grow up alongside of American-born friends and peers. You know, up until late adolescence, most everything that they do does not require legal status. And so they participate in really important defining pathways, activities through school and their neighborhoods. But at a critical time when their friends are moving forward, taking after school jobs, applying for driver's licenses, thinking about college, getting financial aid for college, for the first time in their lives, they're starting to run into walls. And this has, you know, I think that Luis said something about this series of events, and so this really kicks off this chain of events for many of these young people. And so when I started talking to young people in Los Angeles, I was very, very interested in kind of these sociological questions around mobility. But what surprised me very early on, but almost to the person, is the young people that I met were describing physical and emotional manifestations of stress. So chronic headaches, toothaches, trouble sleeping, problems getting out of bed in the morning, what they were calling depression, thoughts of suicide, even attempted suicide. So it became very clear to me this very strong link between undocumented status and strained well-being. So in 2012, when DACA was announced, after, you know, for myself, after spending two decades working on and thinking about this issue, really trying to understand, I was very excited to be able to, in real time, have this opportunity to track young people through a program that was not blocking their access, but what rather was opening it up. So we fielded a national study. We surveyed. In 2013, we surveyed 2,700 DACA-eligible young people, and then we followed it up with face-to-face interviews with 500 young people in three ways. And very early on, it was very clear that DACA beneficiaries, 10 months into the program, were taking giant leaps towards the American mainstream, were obtaining new jobs, were increasing their earnings. They were obtaining driver's licenses, starting to build credit through opening up bank accounts, through obtaining credit cards. So it was really clear this very strong mobility story among DACA beneficiaries. But it was also clear to us as we were looking at the data and talking to people that young people with DACA were using their status. They were extending those benefits to their families and to their communities. So in a mixed status household, for at least one additional member to have access to a driver's license, to have a stay of deportation, to have work authorization, it was a huge game changer for families that allowed DACA beneficiaries to contribute more fully to their families, taking on extra work, making more money to be able to help to pay bills, driving parents to and from work, to and from appointments, that almost overnight, here was a policy of immigrant integration that was having a powerful effect on not only the hundreds of thousands of DACA beneficiaries, but the people closest to them also.
That is Roberto Gonzalez, professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education and director of the school's Immigration Initiative. Professor Gonzalez is author of the award-winning book, Lives in Limbo, Undocumented and Coming of Age in America. We're also joined by Luis Cortez Romero, immigration attorney and partner with the Immigrant Advocacy and Litigation Center. Luis is a DACA recipient. And he is one of the lawyers who defended DACA, I should say, at the Supreme Court. Adrian, before we let you go, I just want to ask, since the election is less than 5 months away, how are you all organizing around that? And how do you all see a path to citizenship?
That's a great question. I think following the ruling on Thursday, I just really hope it motivates the people that make decisions, the people in Capitol Hill on both sides of the aisle, both Democrats and Republicans, to really show the American people that they want to help out the DACA population. They want to pass some type of permanent protection. And I hope it just galvanizes them to finally act, because I've been in this movement for about a decade already. And as a Dreamer, we've been disappointed by both parties, unfortunately, and they keep playing political football with us. My message would be to just educate yourself with the candidates in your local elections and at the national level, and just vote with a person that is really going to look at this situation and be as inclusive as possible, because this country wouldn't be where it is without the power and the history of immigrants.
Adrian Escarte came to the United States when he was just 3 from Santiago, Chile. He put himself through college and is now a professional tennis coach in Florida and communications director of Define American, a media advocacy group that fights injustice and anti-immigrant hate through the power of storytelling. Adrian, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. We're going to take a quick break. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will get an update on the Garment Worker Protection Act, which would guarantee a minimum wage for California's garment workers. The full Senate is voting on the bill tomorrow. We did a show about this last week, and we wanted to do a longer show with more information. Los Angeles has the highest concentration of garment workers in the country. More than 45,000 people, mostly immigrant women, work 10 to 12 hours a day and make as little as $150 a week. So we hope you can join us for that tomorrow. Thursday, we will be getting an update on COVID. Today, we are talking about the Supreme Court's decision to block the Trump administration from ending DACA, or the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. And if you'd like to join us, if you have a story to share, this has been a long fight. What will it take to ensure a path to citizenship? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we're joined by Roberto Gonzalez, professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education and director of the school's Immigration Initiative. He's the author of the award-winning book, Lives in Limbo, Undocumented and Coming of Age in America. We're also joined by Luis Cortez Romero. Luis is an immigration attorney and partner with the Immigrant Advocacy and Litigation Center. Luis received DACA status in 2013. 6 years later, he was one of the lawyers defending the program at the Supreme Court. Let's spend a little bit of time talking about what this means moving forward. Luis, what should we know about how it extends protections for Dreamers? And do you have any idea how the administration is going to respond to this, if at all?
Sure. So What the Supreme Court decision does is that it invalidates the decision to terminate the program. So what it will do is that it will restore the program in full back to when it was announced in 2012. And so, and this is important because during the course of this litigation, when we started in September of 2017, one of the things that we were able to get was an injunction from the San Francisco court, Judge Alsup, who is in the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California, and that's actually where the majority of the case was argued, was in San Francisco. It placed an injunction where it did not allow for new applications for DACA, but it allowed for people who had DACA already to continue to renew. So that's kind of the status we were living, or the legal status and framework that we were had moving forward from 2017. What this means is that we have a mini generation of Dreamers who were eligible to apply for DACA, or who become eligible to apply for DACA, and then did not get an opportunity to do so. Now they will have an opportunity to do so now that the program is restored. Now, since the decision, President Trump and his administration has had some very sharp words about the decision, you know, calling it a shotgun blast to the face of anyone who considers themselves a conservative or Republican. But, you know, what we don't see is we don't see any real mechanics or any real plan as to what they're going to do next. To that extent, a lot of the statements that the Department of Homeland Security and President Trump have issued has been mostly just venting. But what we do know is that if President Trump tries to terminate the program again, it has to follow the Administrative and Procedures Act, the APA. Otherwise, again, it would be considered arbitrary and capricious. And to do that, President Trump is going to have to consider on paper all of the consequences that terminating the program would have, including terminating the program for healthcare workers who are DACA recipients, who are agricultural workers, who are picking the food we eat, particularly in light of a pandemic. And so he's going to have to really own those decisions. And the other thing to consider is that the DACA program is an overwhelmingly supported program here in the United States, where somewhere about 8 out of 10 people on both sides of the political aisle agree that the DACA program should stay. And, you know, quite frankly, I don't know any other thing that 8 out of 10 people agree with at all, you know, let alone something so controversial as an immigration subject. And so he's going to have to do that all leading up to November. And it doesn't give him enough time to do it by November. But even if he were to try, you know, it's not going to be cost neutral. It will impact, I think, voters' decisions come November, and he's going to have to think about that if he decides to terminate the program again. So we don't know exactly what they're going to do. That, you know, they've had some sharp words for it, but we do know that if they try again, it's going to be costly politically. And again, we will be there to protect the DACA program if he decides to start again. Now, we do know that the administrative agency, the Department of Homeland Security, who is the one that administers the program, they are to issue guidance about what the next steps are, when they're going to take new applications for those who didn't apply at the time. And so we're waiting for that to see. We expect that to have that within the next few weeks. In the meantime, I think what Dreamers should do, the ones who didn't get to apply for the first time, is to get their documentation ready. The DACA application is very bulky. You have to prove that you have been in the United States, you know, since 2007. So it's 13 years worth of evidence and documents you have to collect, and that all takes time. So one of the things that, you know, Dreamers should really do right now is start getting that evidence ready while we wait for agency guidance. Mm.
To your point about frontline workers, let's just first talk about people working in hospitals. Professor Gonzalez, according to a statement from the American Medical Association that was sent to the Supreme Court last week, nearly 30,000 Dreamers work as healthcare professionals across the United States. There's also a group called Pre-Health Dreamers, which was started by 3 undocumented youth in the Bay Area. And they represent 1,000 undocumented students in the healthcare field across the United States. Because of DACA, they've been able to get into medical school and work as doctors. Professor Gonzalez? Did we lose Professor Gonzalez? Luis, while we reconnect with him, can you comment on that?
Yeah, so, you know, I think there's some interesting coincidences here. First, you know, Pre-Healthcare Dreamers was started. One of the founders was Nu Levitascorn, who's now a doctor in the Bay Area fighting COVID-19. And he's actually one of our plaintiffs who, you know, when we filed a lawsuit back in 2017, he's one of our named plaintiffs, one of the six DACA recipients that represents the cross-section of different DACA recipients. And I think it really underscores the importance of what having DACA looks like, particularly in the state of emergency. The American Medical Association could not have been more precise in October of 2019 when they filed their documents in support of DACA. It's called an amicus brief. And one of the things that the brief outlined for the American Medical Association is that they said, if in the event that there's a global pandemic, we're going to need the DACA recipient healthcare workers to be on all hands on deck. And without them, and if we happen to have a global pandemic, you know, it'll be catastrophic. And it, weirdly enough, you know, come March, there's a global pandemic. And healthcare workers are now the most important workers that we have, including, you know, the DACA recipients who are nurses, nurse practitioners, EMTs, doctors like Nu, who's our, you know, one of the lead plaintiffs on the case. And so it becomes so important that, you know, that we provide some of the resources for DACA recipients to thrive. And one of the things that I think is very important about Professor Gonzalez's work and all the research that he's done since DACA is that it's an unqualified success. And what we see on a broader spectrum is that if we're providing immigrants with access and resources to more formally contribute to our society by giving them a social security number and a work permit and even just, you know, a temporary status to be here, what we've seen, and this really serves as a case study, is that we all do better. We all do better for it, and so we're hoping that this really serves as a platform and blueprint to expand these protections to, you know, the broader immigrant community. Right. Aside from the American Healthcare Association or American Medical Association, there have been companies too that filed amicus briefs. Fortune 500 companies, including Uber, Facebook, Apple. Tim Cook filed one on his own personal behalf that said that DACA recipients contribute billions to the economy. And again, that could not have been more important given that the economy right now is struggling because of the pandemic. And what we see is that DACA recipients are oftentimes job creators, hiring U.S. citizens. The average DACA recipient who has a business hires on average 2 to 3 U.S. citizens. And so without DACA, you know, these 2 to 3 U.S. citizens will be out of a job. And again, we're talking on average. And one of the things that the companies had foreshadowed was if we end DACA, it would cost the American economic system billions of dollars. You know, and so again, some of the arguments that were highlighted in November and October are really coming to fruition now. And that's the stories that we saw that Chief Justice Roberts really, I think, clung onto. The ruling was based on the Administrative Procedures Act, but just Chief Justice Roberts did go into depth about the stories of the DACA recipients and how much the communities relied on the DACA recipients, and to just sweep the rug underneath the DACA recipients that was once used as a welcome mat is going to be not just catastrophic to DACA recipients, but our entire community. And so, and we're seeing that, you know, primarily going back to your question with the healthcare workers.
Can we talk about what this means for other immigrants, immigrants who are still living in the shadows, immigrants who do not have basic rights? For example, we're doing a show tomorrow about garment workers in Los Angeles. They're paid per piece. They make as little as $150 a week. We've done so many shows about farm workers who are on the front lines of COVID. We recently did a show, and according to Ann Lopez, who runs the Center for Farmworker Families, most of California's farm workers make $20,000 a year or less. Two-thirds of more than 500,000 farm workers are undocumented. They have no health insurance, no basic protections. In fact, Dr. Lopez said she's never seen it so bad for farm workers. So how will this affect other immigrants who you know, do not have degrees and are not doctors or working in hospitals?
Sure. So, you know, if we're one of the things that Professor Gonzalez had mentioned a little earlier was oftentimes DACA recipients live in mixed status families. So there's some of their status, some of the families don't have status. Some of the families are U.S. citizens. And so having DACA continue to be protected will help DACA recipients provide for and help economically their family members and their household who maybe don't have any status, who might be even more severely economically disenfranchised. So for, you know, the parents who are making $20,000 a year, a DACA recipient son or daughter will be able to help at least economically with that because they have some of the more basic building blocks to participate in our community. But I think it only also goes to show the need for an expansion of this of this program to protect other immigrants, because without it, it does lead to the exploitation of labor. You know, if individuals are nervous or afraid of being deported, then it's quite easy, and you know, we don't have to imagine too hard of an employer saying, well, you know, I'm going to pay them less than minimum wage because if you complain, then I will just, you know, threaten you with deportation. And that threat of being deported and separated from your family, separated from your kids, is a very deep threat where, you know, it does silence a lot of immigrants. Right. And so it really highlights the need for broader protection. The other thing that I think would mention that this win does for the immigrant community at large is that it reminds me a lot of what got us DACA to begin with, which was the direct and persistent activism and nonviolent protest by immigrant rights groups that ultimately led President Obama to provide this protection. It should be very clear that the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, DACA, was not a gift from Obama. It was a political concession in 2012 after persistent activism. And what, you know, looking at the history of DACA, President Obama from 2008 to 2012 was on pace to deport more people than any other president in the United States. He was on pace to deport more people than George W. Bush did on both his terms. So the immigrants' rights movement shifted from, you know, getting citizenship and legal status for all to stopping the deportations of young people, you know, because they were happening en masse. So the coalition of immigrants' rights groups then really, you know, got together and showed a lot of activism. And, you know, to no surprise, 2012, an election year, President Obama was held to account about the original platform that he ran on, which was to protect immigrants' rights. And ultimately, that's not what he was doing. So he provided DACA after being, you know, pressured to do so by the immigrants' rights groups. And so, you know, it really goes to show the power of activism in doing that. And I think also that's what really helps protect DACA at the Supreme Court. You know, we had great legal arguments, but, you know, it was the persistent activism, too, where we saw that we not just won in the court of law, but we're winning in the court of public opinion, where now DACA is widely supported. But those are the next steps that we need to follow. And it does, you know, provide a bit of a, I look at President or Vice President Joe Biden's candidacy and his promises about broader immigration reform with a bit of a jaundiced eye, because he was working with President Obama when President Obama was deporting a lot of people. And so what we do know is that, you know, we will continue to protect immigrants' rights. Even if President Trump tries to end DACA again, we will press him to protect immigrants' rights, just like we did his predecessor and just how we will do his successor.
Yeah, it's unclear where Biden stands. His immigration page on his website is very long, but it doesn't seem to be that straightforward. I mean, he talks about, you know, undoing Trump's damage, reclaiming America's values. You know, you hear this often from Democrats, but do you know what would he actually do?
Yeah, you know, I think there's two things that he can do. The first one is, you know, press on Congress for broader immigration protection. And I think, you know, that's one of the things that he has at least vocalized that he says he wants to do within this first few days of office. But I think that the other really important thing that is oftentimes goes unnoticed is to have a very in-tune cabinet. The Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, the Attorney General, both have a lot to do with how immigration laws are ultimately administered. During President Obama, or sorry, during President Trump's tenure, he's had Attorney General Bill Barr, Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who have caused significant structural damage to the integrity of the immigration system by streamlining deportations, really undercutting the amount of rights that immigrants have, going as far as saying that two-year-olds in immigration court should not have a right to an attorney or a government-appointed attorney, that they can go ahead and represent themselves. And so one of the things that we are very much hoping for President or Vice President Biden to do if he's elected is to make sure that he's picking cabinet members who are in tune with the mechanics of immigration law and immigration procedure, because he can restore some of that by policymaking, administrative action, following the Administrative and Procedures Act, to restore some of the integrity that goes into our immigration system while we work with Congress to have broader immigration reform. And there is an immigration reform bill, or at least for a protection for Dreamers, at the passed the House now. It is waiting for Senate approval. So the Senate majority really kind of needs to get its act together and also try to pass this along. And if President Biden or Vice President Biden ends up winning, then that's one of the things that hopefully he can help push along.
Given that the election is in less than 5 months, if Mitch McConnell remains Senate Majority Leader and the Senate remains in Republican hands, will it be possible to see a path to citizenship?
Well, I mean, I think it is entirely possible, given in the state of where we are in our society. You know, I think Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, is going to need to realize that there is a movement going on right now, not just with the immigrants' rights movement, but we're seeing with broader civil rights movements that are calling for a change of how we, not just how we do things, but a change of how we see things. And I think that either, Senator McConnell is going to have to acknowledge that, or, he's going to have to realize that his seat might be in trouble. And I don't think he can take his Senate seat for as granted. You know, the Kentucky primaries are very much being closely watched. They're getting a lot of attention. And so if he ends up not, really working across the aisle to come up with a broader immigration fix, then, it's going to be damaging to the state of Kentucky. It's going to be damaging to the rest of the United States that oftentimes benefits from the contributions of immigrants, immigrant labor and immigrant contributions. And then he's going to have to face his constituency. So, I think sooner rather than later, he needs to realize that this is a long time coming and that it's, he does not and should not be on the losing side of the battle. The other point, too, is that I think it would really behoove Senator McConnell to embrace some of the immigrant community, because oftentimes the immigrant community also comes with a lot of conservative values. You know, there's a lot of immigrant communities who believe in small government because they are refugees that are running away from bigger government. A lot of the immigrant community are religious, which is also very much a conservative value. And so the Republican Party has a lot aligned with the immigrant community, except for immigration itself. And so I think that the sooner Senator McConnell realizes that, the sooner he might even just be able to expand his base. I think that the usual way of doing things is getting thrown out the window, and we're seeing that now in great strides across the country. And so either Senator McConnell gets with it or he doesn't, and then people are going to have to make decisions come November.
Yeah, and that Kentucky primary is happening today, so it's going to be interesting to see what happens with that. Luis, we have just about a minute left, and I just want to ask you, Trump is taking his first trip to the U.S.-Mexico border today. And I'm just reading from CNN here. Over the course of his administration, they've engaged in an increasingly aggressive land grab along the southwest border, and they did not pause it during COVID. Can you just give us a quick update in our remaining minutes?
Yeah, we know that President Trump has, made it a goal in his presidency to build his wall and to allocate all scarce resources to that. And, he continues to do so amidst legal battles of getting, other getting land to be able to build that wall. And some of it is in private property. Some of it is in indigenous land. And so he's, you know, not only is he facing criticism, but he's going to be facing a lot of legal battles doing so. I'm interested to see what ultimately he will conclude on his trip to the border, because what we do know is that, and this kind of goes through the research that's been done for decades, that a wall does not necessarily stop immigration or immigrants from coming into the United States, because, you know, there is a majority of them that are coming through visas. And so it really just goes to feed his rhetoric, even though, you know, it's filled with flaws.
And 1 minute, how much is at stake for immigrants in this election?
There is a humongous stake here for immigrants, and not just in the ability to secure their unification with their families, but we're seeing now, and this was, you know, announced yesterday, that President Trump is trying to also undercut legal migration. He has stopped the issuance of visas for employment-based visas. He also put a moratorium, you know, even before then. So the way in which America looks and how the immigrant community looks within it is very much at stake this election. And I think it's very, very important for people to become involved and vote to be able to get rid of this agenda, because it's an agenda that him and Stephen Miller have ran on from day one. And so if he is reelected, then, you know, obviously we have a lot of problems in our hands, but immigration is going to be one big one.
Well, Luis, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Luis Cortez Romero came to California as a toddler from Mexico and is a DACA recipient. Receiving DACA in 2013 changed his life. 6 years later, he was one of the lawyers defending the program at the Supreme Court. Luis Cortez Romero is an immigration attorney and partner with the Immigrant Advocacy and Litigation Center in Washington State. And in February, he surprised his mom by reuniting her with her parents after 3 decades of them not seeing each other. Her parents live in Mexico. You can find more information about DACA and what's next at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance and Damian Miner for keeping our studio running. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.